This is the Mason Vera Payne Show,
your go-to lifestyle podcast, covering everything from technology and gaming
to movies, TV shows, and pop culture to the supernatural and beyond.
Brought to you from Chicago, USA,
with your host, the unabridged millennial, Mason Vera Payne.
This is the unabridged millennial, Mason Vera Payne, and thank you for tuning in. Recently, I started reading a book called Rock and Roll Myths and Legends. This book talks about the supernatural aspect of rock and roll. Joining me today is the author of the book, Gary Patterson. Thank you for joining me, Gary.
Love to be there.
You know, I was reading through your book, Take a Walk on the Dark Side, Rock and Roll Myths, Legends, and Curses, and I loved how well written it was. And so, you know, I went and I was like, oh, he must have like a really good editor. So I looked through it and, you know, didn't have one. So I read the back and it says, you're a teacher. And I was like, that's great. But how does a teacher start writing about, you know, rock and roll myths? How did this happen?
Wow, that's a great question. Well, first of all, I grew up at a time when rock and roll was at its peak, which means I grew up with the Beatles and the Stones and Zeppelin, Hendrix, all of that. And I'm a musician, too. Because I play guitar, and I used to play in a band, and we used to play around, opened up for a number of acts, and I've always loved the music. When you love the music, you hear the stories. The higher you get up the ladder, the more you hear some of the more interesting stories, let's say. And so when I did the book as an English teacher, I've always heard the story of the tragical history of Dr. Faustus, Goethe's Faust, the devil and Daniel Webster, Young Goodman Brown, all those stories had to do with selling your soul to the devil, going to a crossroads. And then I was thinking, if you did that in a lit class, why not throw in Robert Johnson, the father of rock and roll, according to, Jimmy Page and some of the others, because his unique guitar playing actually turned on a lot of the great British invasion guitarists, like, well, for instance, Eric Clapton, who even did an album, Me and Mr. Johnson. So now you have that story that goes with the others. So I was thinking, you know, you could really make that an interesting class in a high school course or a college class. And then I thought, well, if I start with Robert Johnson, let's add other chapters. And it's kind of unique because I was the first guy who ever did the story about the club, the 27 Club, and it didn't exist until my second book. So now anytime a rock star dies at the age of 27, I get a phone call. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it is. But you know what? I was reading through it, and I really liked how you put a lot of research into it. And it wasn't just about, you know, the rock and roll legends and all, but it was also about history. You talked about Nathaniel Hawthorne, and you talked about, you know, Hamlet. And, you know, how did you incorporate your obviously your profession as an English teacher and your love for rock and roll, like how did it come together to just be all about these people?
Well, to be honest with you, it's universal themes. You know, like when Shakespeare, some of his concepts that a lot of students think, well, you know, gosh, why do we have to read 17th century literature? But, you know, what it does, it transcends time. And when I read Hamlet, it's like, for instance, you know, the death of David Bowie.
Yeah.
And I was watching the video, one of his videos, and it had this human skull sitting there. And when I see that human skull, I know that there was a lot of mystical societies that believe the human skull is important because it's to show that tomorrow we die. Well, to me, it goes right back to John Donne. When John Donne had his portrait painted in a burial shroud. So he looked at it every day, and he even starts meditation number 17 that has no man as an island. It has that image. And in Hamlet, when Hamlet picks up Yorick's skull, and he notices the skull is smiling, and the idea is the skull smiling because it knows one day we join it. Well, that's the same thing as Bowie saw in his new video on Black Star. So when I look at all that, you know, it all, to me, it all just makes perfect sense. It goes through because the universal themes of literature, the universal themes of mankind, either in poetry or in music, they're basically the same. And it's kind of unique that students can see that and we can see it. I mean, I've got a background in Shakespeare, the Romantics, all of that in literature, and it's kind of easy to me to see that Lord Byron would have been you know, a perfect rock star. That's the 20th century. So, you know, it all just fits.
You know, not only does it fit, but I also liked how you brought together your research skills, because I think that was really important in the creation of this book, because you touched on how when it came to Robert Johnson, that they, you know, when they came from Africa, there were a lot of, what is those missionaries that went over there. So, you know, they had their African cultures and, you know, the Christianity came together and it kind of formed all these legends and the myths behind just, you know, how Robert Johnson became such a good guitarist. But my thing is that where the origin of the myths and, you know, the curses kind of start? Is it just lore?
Well, actually, I think you'd look at Robert Johnson as the first great urban legend. And when I saw the movie, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? You remember the scene where they pick up the black guitar player and he tells them he just sold his soul to the devil?
Yeah, I remember that.
Well, that thing goes in, but it wasn't Robert Johnson. The guy's name in the movie was Tommy Johnson. And if you really do your research to the Mississippi Delta, Tommy Johnson and his brother Liddell Johnson were the ones who started the story about selling your soul to the devil. And it wasn't Tommy, it was his brother Liddell. So the whole idea about the crossroad myths and where it goes back into Africa, you know, the guardian of the crossroads, Legba, and it goes into the cross into Christianity, as you're talking about. You have the origin that shows how effective it was. And why crossroads? Well, in medieval time periods, that men who were hanged, their corpses were buried in crossroads so that people could walk over them. Witches were buried at crossroads after hangings in the United States. So what a better place for evil spirits to meet than at a crossroads. And I've actually been to the crossroads in Clarksdale, Mississippi.
Really?
I've stood there, yeah. And I have it to tell you, I went with a group of friends, and we left from Memphis, and we went to Clarksdale, and we found the crossroads, and there's a cemetery next to it that started in 1850. And this was the cemetery that Robert Johnson claimed the devil taught him to play the guitar at. So we took 8 pictures with digital camera of us standing in the crossroads in the back. None of those pictures came out.
Wow.
None of them. And one of the girls who was with us, for some strange reason, there was this huge black snake, and it was coiled around a tombstone. And for some unknown reason, she takes the stick and starts hitting at the snake. And I told her, I said, you know, if I were you, I don't think I would bother that snake. I said, it's a little symbolism here. So, you know, she listened. She dropped the stick. And as we were leaving, my fraternity brother I went with, he said, you know what we got to do? He said, we got to bring some dirt back. So here he and I are kneeling down, digging up dirt from the center of this crossroads, putting it in plastic sandwich bags. And we drove down to Tunica, where the casinos were, and it must have worked pretty good for me. I won about $250 playing blackjack. And then the next day we went to Memphis, back to Memphis, and it was on a Sunday morning. We got up, left, and I drove to Nashville to meet my attorney and also had dinner with him and with Jamie Oldacre, who was Eric Clapton's drummer, and also with Leo Lyons, who was the bass player from 10 Years After. We all had dinner. And I said, you know, guys, I said, I've got some interesting dirt in my car. And Jamie Oldacre said, oh, don't bring that stuff in here. It said it's got too much mojo. And, I mean, he was serious.
Oh, wow.
And, of course, Leo, yeah, let me see it, let me see it. So, anyway, my dirt got misplaced. The girl I was with, accidentally, somehow the dirt got in her car. I didn't have my cell phone on after I left Nashville. When I got home, I had all these phone calls, and it appears as soon as I got, within 2 hours of leaving Memphis, the girl who had hit the snake with the stick, she was rushed to the hospital, and she had a brain aneurysm.
Oh, my God.
And she survived. The guy who dug the dirt up with me, within 15 minutes of leaving, he was rushed to the hospital with a heart attack and was in intensive care. The girl who took the dirt back with her I got a call from her. Her lights were flashing on her house. Her burglar alarm had gone off. Her motion detectors were picking up something, and she was terrified. So the next day, she goes to work. The alarm goes off again, and I said, look, take that dirt and throw it in the river, because she was convinced she had brought back some sort of evil spirit. I said, just throw it in the river. So she did. I didn't hear anything else from that. So I guess it was about 3 weeks later, I had had a birthday party. It was a surprise birthday. They showed up, and I noticed I had this interesting package, and when I opened it, it was a antique glass bottle with a cork stopper from like the 1930s and 40s, and inside that bottle was half a bottle full of dirt from the crossroads. And it was given to me by Alan, the guy who'd had the heart attack, and it said Crossroads 2001. So right now, as I'm talking to you, I'm looking at it right now, and nothing happened to me. But, you know, maybe it's because I knew the legend, and I sort of I always respect legends, but it seems like it was very coincidental that all that happened to the people who were there. And it's not glowing green. Of course, I got to admit, I went to Italy that summer, and I brought back a blessed crucifix from Pope John Paul II. So on the left side of my computer screen, I have the dirt, and on the right side, I have the crucifix, so maybe it balances it out.
Oh, yeah, they nullify each other, definitely.
They do.
You know, there have always been, I think, an interest in crossroads. You see them in literature, you see it in video games, movies, TV shows. I think the TV show that sticks out the most for me is Supernatural, is because, you know, Sam and Dean are always jumping at a crossroad at some point in you know, the season to always make a deal with Crowley or some other demon. And I'm just curious, you know, you talk specifically about artists and musicians, but do businessmen make deals at crossroad? Is this like anybody can go there?
Well, you know, to be honest, watching Supernatural, I just wonder if they maybe read my book a little bit. But
I think so, definitely.
I think that, you know, if the devil's out snaring souls, I mean, a blues guitar player and a businessman, I mean, like a Donald Trump or something, you know, who knows? Maybe they've already been to the crossroads. But, you know, the whole deal is that you'd be given fame and you'd die at a young age. Because even if you go back into history, and I have this in my book, if you study Alexander the Great, he said that Zeus appeared to him and gave him two options. He could live to be an old man, but not know fame and not know glory. Or he could choose the short life, and then he'd be known forever. He'd become immortal. So he chose the short life. And, of course, Alexander died at the age of 33. Now, I could sit here and tell you, oh, you know, hey, Alexander the Great died at 33. Jesus Christ was crucified at 33. 3 times 3 is 9. 2 plus 7 is 9. And a lot of people get into the numerology of it, like the 27 Club. But, you know, I don't think that there is a, oh, I don't know, I don't think there's an application you have to fill out with by waiting at a crossroads. But one thing I will tell you is that when I first started going on Coast to Coast and we talk about stuff like this, I got a lot of interesting emails from musicians who said they did the deal.
Really?
Yeah, and it was at the same crossroads in Clarksdale. And, you know, so I read this and I sort of smile a little bit and shake my head. But, you know, who knows? I mean, it's a great legend. It started with Robert Johnson, but Robert Johnson was so little known. I mean, Eric Clapton did a lot for Robert Johnson when he did Crossroads with Cream. And if you listen to the lyric, I went down to the crossroads and fell down on my knees, ask the Lord of above have mercy, save poor Bob if you please. And, you know, there seems to be something there. I know Robert Johnson today, part of the legend, he's buried in 3 graves. Or I should say, there are 3 places that claim to be his grave, and in Greenwood, Mississippi. So, you know, it's just part of this fabulous legend. And I'm sure that there are a lot of people who'd like to become famous, and they're probably setting out on a deserted crossroads in Mississippi at night with their guitar. and waiting for some presence to walk up from behind them, but they dare not turn their head. And all they do is pass the guitar over their right shoulder, and they'll notice the guitar's taken and hear it tuned to a special tuning and pass back. And once they take the guitar back, the deal's made. So if that happens, if it's a business contract, you know, it's sent over. And if it's to buy real estate or create software, who knows? But it's a part of literature. And if it was Jabez Stone with Stephen Vincent Vinay or Faust or anyone else, you know, it's still the idea to get something quick and to become immortal. And that's the thing about rock and roll. When these guys and, well, girls also, when they pass away at early ages, they become immortal because every time we turn on our radio, we hear them singing to us. Every time we turn on, well, we used to say we could turn on MTV and VH1 and watch them, but if we watch a video, we can see them performing. They're forever young. I mean, forever 27. You know, Jim Morrison, the others are there. So whatever secret it was, they did reach immortality. Just like in Greek mythology, they're great heroes and they're great soldiers and all that make up legends. So they become part of it too. And I think that's the thing, to leave something behind.
Oh, absolutely. It's all about immortality. You know, a lot of people, it's not just about the fame or the money. It's about leaving an impression on a generation and on society in general. But, you know, I was just curious because you keep saying that the crossroad, it's in Mississippi, Clarksdale.
Yeah.
Is there any other crossroads that people go to make a deal or that's in a legend somewhere or a myth? Or...
Now, you're not writing this down, are you? I mean, you're not going to be heading out somewhere in Chicago. I mean, now, let's face it. Wouldn't Chicago be a great place?
Absolutely. I would think Massachusetts,
gosh,
Waters,
too. Howlin' Wolf, Chess Records, my goodness, the City of the Blues. I mean, if something came from the Delta with Muddy Waters, and he had mojo, and he brought it to Chicago, there's got to be a place in Chicago.
Oh, definitely. But, you know, I'm just curious about it because, you know, when I was reading the book and, you know, I listened to Coast myself, I've always thought, you know, like, why isn't there any other crossroads? Like, it's supernatural. I feel like they just go to any old place and, you know, they find a tin in the middle of the road and they put their ID and other stuff in there. And I'm just curious, is there any other place that has like a partial legend to it? Because I'm sure, you know, there are other legends out there, like people going to graveyards and doing things.
Of course. Let's take a look at the Allman Brothers. All right.
Okay.
If you go to Macon, Georgia, there's a very famous cemetery down there. It's called Rose Hill Cemetery. And when the Allman Brothers Band moved to Macon, Georgia from Jacksonville, Florida, and they took up residence at the big house, they would go at night into Rose Hill Cemetery and play the guitars and write songs. Now, why do you think they went to a cemetery to play the guitar and write songs? Well, that's what Robert Johnson did, according to the legend. So when you go to Rose Hill, it's easy to see Elizabeth Reed's grave, the grave of Little Martha, all of these things where the brothers sat and they played the guitars. And, you know, whether it was following Robert Johnson, playing the guitar in graveyards at night like Robert Johnson did, where the devil was his instructor. And then the strange thing with the death of Duane Allman, where, you know, I have to admit, I saw Duane Allman with the Allman Brothers when I was in college. And it was in 1970. They had just recorded Live at the Fillmore, but it hadn't been released. It was right after Idle Wild South. It was one of the most incredible performances I'd ever seen. But right after that, in Nashville, he took an opium overdose, and they rushed him to the hospital, and his fingertips had turned blue. And the emergency room doctor comes out to the band, and he says, look, he's really bad shape. I don't think he's going to make it, so prepare yourselves. And Barry Oakley, the bass player, goes outside running into the parking lot, falls on his knees, and he starts to pray, and he says, oh, God, just give him one more year to live. Now, I think this was October 20th, 1970. And after an hour, and Barry Oakley just sobbing in the parking lot, the doctor gathers the band together, and he says, look, I don't know how to tell you this, but he's going to make it. Well, 1 year to the day, October 20th, 1971, Duane Allman was killed in a motorcycle accident. Barry Oakley asked for 1 year. He got 1 year. 1 year and 13 days later, after Duane Allman's death, Barry Oakley was killed a few hundred feet away in another intersection. And he hit a bus, was killed. Both of them were buried. And the strangest thing, Mace, is that Duane Allman was not buried after his death, not until Barry Oakley died. They buried them both together. They had his body in storage.
Oh, wow.
Yes, and they were both buried at Rose Hill Cemetery side by side. Now, what do we have? They were killed in an intersection. An intersection is a crossroads.
Right.
And Barry Oakley had made a deal. Just give him one more year. Now, who heard the deal? Because after Allman died exactly 1 year to that day, 1 year, 13 days later, an unlucky 13 days later, Barry Oakley died a few hundred feet away in another crossroads, an intersection. So do you make a deal in the churchyard? You know, being from Chicago and in the Chicago market, Muddy Waters, you know, with Chess Records, I know that when Muddy Waters toured with Eric Clapton, one of Muddy Waters' band members offered his red Telecaster to Eric Clapton to play. And Eric Clapton wouldn't touch it. He said, no, too much mojo, just too much mojo. He's not worthy. And the strange thing about Muddy Waters' death is that at his funeral, before they interred him, they took his guitar and put it in the coffin with him, which is not unusual for a great blues player, but when they shut the lid of the coffin, they broke the neck of the guitar. And when they took him to the cemetery, there was a flower arrangement that looked like his red Telecaster. And as they were lowering the coffin into the grave, a wind came up and it broke the neck in the exact location of the floral arrangement, which really freaked some people out at the funeral, which it should, I guess. So we're talking about mojo, and you're talking about making a deal. You know, the Allman Brothers played in cemeteries at night. So I guess I have to tell you, Mason, that would be a good cemetery to start.
Not just any cemetery.
I'm not sure if you have too many rural crossroads in Chicago. So
no, not too many that I can think of offhand. But, you know, what you're talking about is there's so many coincidences. And, you know, I don't like to believe in coincidences. After, you know, two, three, four times, it seems like it's more of a pattern. And
yeah.
You found that pattern in rock and roll. Did you ever find anything like in disco music or R&B or, you know, slow jazz?
Well, you take R&B, R&B is rock and roll. I mean, everything goes back together. If you take a look at the beginning, at that crossroads in the 1930s, you had the blues, and then you had rhythm and blues, and you had country music with Hank Williams, and you had all of that started in the South and made its way up as it was carried. So when we talk about, coincidence. One of the best explanations for a coincidence is a coincidence is an explanation waiting to happen. Okay? Mm. And when you have Rock Stars Who Died 27, for me, when I found the club and we were talking about it, and I did it on VH1 and E and a lot of the others talking about curses, the whole idea was I didn't want to say, well, he was in his 27th year of life, so he was really 26. I didn't want to do that because I thought it would water it down. I went straight 27. If I'd gone to 26, I'd had Otis Redding, Graham Parsons. There's so many more that you could have put in who were almost 27, but in their 27th year. But my requirement was you had to already be 27. And there were over 42 rock stars who died at that age.
Oh, wow.
Now, it's not just, you know, the most, well, they're very famous. But when I wrote about it in the book, I didn't put Gary Thane, who was the bass player in Uriah Heep, even though, yes, he was 27, I tried to concentrate mainly on the major icons, the major influence. So that's why I didn't put 42 in the book, but there are over 42. And I'll guarantee you, when I was headed to Florida on vacation 1 year, I had 50 phone calls when Amy Winehouse died.
Absolutely. I was thinking that one, too.
Yeah, because she was 27. And it went back to the whole story of Hawaii 27 and the great coincidence. And there's so many of these. I mean, it's like Buddy Holly. Every February 3rd, there's all this interest in Buddy Holly and his death and the curse and everybody who replaced him, what happened to him. And, you know, why is February 3rd a bad day for rock stars and September 7th his birthday? And, you know, you take all that, and in the book, it's the Buddy Holly curse. It's one of the chapters. And then I was just noticing today, you know, we had the loss, well, not today, but when Lemmy died, you know, and then we had David Bowie died. And, you know, they usually die in threes. Well, I just found out Glenn Frey died from the Eagles today.
Yeah.
So now we have three. And I was thinking, well, maybe it's Natalie Cole. But, you know, Natalie Cole didn't fit into that pattern. And you can make it fit. I mean, I could go back and say, well, how about the singer in the Easy Beats, you know? He died. But, you know, it had to be sort of a major icon with it. So it was terrible at losing Glenn Frey, David Bowie, and Lemmy from Motorhead. And, you know, you can see the impact of these very powerful figures and when they lose. So I don't know. Is there something about death in threes? Is there something about rock stars who died 27 one year? I did this on Coast to Coast. We had three rock stars die, and they died in alphabetical order.
Really? Who was it?
Well, it started with Gene Pitney, and then one of the Pointer Sisters. So that was BPO, PIPO, and the last one was Billy Preston, PR.
Oh wow! Yeah, you're right.
All three of them, and I'm talking about within a week. Blam, blam, blam. I'm glad they skipped PA. I mean. I'm a rock historian, but, you know, I've never seen it line up like that. And, I mean, is that a coincidence? I mean, I don't know why I always see this. I mean, when something happens, you know, the way my mind works, I say, you know, this is very unique, very unusual. So now it looks like I'm going to have a lot more stuff for my next book.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, it's not... I mean, especially with David Bowie, nobody really knew something was wrong with him, and he was bringing out albums. So it was kind of a shock, at least as a fan, like, you know, just you didn't expect it. And I sometimes wonder, is that what kind of prompts these, like the 27 Club and, you know, just rock legends in general? Is it like you're reflecting on your own, you know, your own life, like your own death maybe?
Well, what? It usually gets to me, my phone sort of cut out for a second, but what it usually gets to me is that when I see it, I look for parallels. I look for relationships. You know, if it's if it came from Seattle with Kurt Cobain, then it made me think how many rock stars' deaths have been attributed to murder or how many were just natural causes. And, you know, when I think about Cobain, and I'm sitting here thinking, there's a lot that does not make sense about his death. And now there's a number of documentaries and movies that are coming out that are pointing some things out. But, I mean, to me, it's just very mysterious. I don't know why anybody would take enough heroin to kill themselves, you know, within seconds and then have to shoot yourself in the mouth with a shotgun. I mean, it seems like it would be much easier just to go to sleep and not do the second part. And what happened with Brian Jones? I mean, there were witnesses who came forward and said they saw two men holding him underwater, but they didn't say anything because they were threatened. Well, if you go to London and you turn that in, they'll say, well, it's death by misadventure, and today everybody who is involved has passed away, so it doesn't serve any purpose. Well, there's a thing called the truth. I guess a month ago I recorded an interview with James Tabby Wright, who was a roadie for Jimi Hendrix. And he told a story that I have on tape where he says that Hendrix was murdered by Mike Jeffrey, who was his manager, who had three men go into his London flat, Hendrix, and that Monica Daneman, his girlfriend at the time, had given him 9 sleeping tablets to keep him unconscious, and they effectively waterboarded him by taking bottles of wine and pouring it down his throat and drowned him in wine. And when the ambulance came to pick him up, Monica Damon says she was there. She rode to the ambulance with him, that the way his body was arranged in the ambulance, that he asphyxiated. But even the doctor said he would be all right when they got to the hospital. Well, it turns out that the ambulance drivers, once interviewed, said that no one was in the apartment. The door was open, and when they walked in, they found Hendricks, and he was already dead.
Oh, wow.
And when they took him to the London Hospital, and this is what always got me, the doctor, the coroner, said that there was at least a bottle of wine in his hair. He'd been saturated with it.
Right.
And that when they did the toxicology report, there was just enough alcohol in his bloodstream to be like drinking a beer.
Huh.
Yet wine was oozing from his mouth, which means that when he died, the alcohol had not gone into his bloodstream.
Right, right. It was poured on him.
Right. Now, why would he do that? Because Hendricks was leaving Mike Jeffrey. Mike Jeffrey had borrowed a great deal of money from the mob in New York, over $200,000. And if Hendricks had left him, there's no way he could pay it back. But Jimi Hendricks had a $2 million life insurance policy. So if he died, then what would happen? Jeffrey would inherit the $2 million. He'd pay off the money owed. And then he would have the royalties and everything else, and he would set himself up. So Hendricks did die. However, Wright implicates Monica Daneman into the murder. And the odd thing is, Mason, when they called for Mike Jeffrey to fly back to England for an inquest, the plane he was flying in from Spain blew up, and they found Mike Jeffrey's watch, but nothing else. But Mike Jeffrey was like MI6, James Bond. He'd worked in demolitions in the British Secret Service. So there are some people saying that he even rigged the plane to explode so he could disappear. Now, that's out there. But it's really odd that he's gone. And then right after, there was a lawsuit brought against Monica Daneman by Kathy Etchingham, who Hendricks' first girlfriend in London, who he wrote The Wind Cries Mary for. She had sued her and lost, or Monica Daneman had lost, and she commits suicide. Devon Wilson, who Jimi Hendricks had written a song for, Dolly Dagger, right after his funeral, a few weeks later, takes a swan dive off the Hotel Chelsea. A lot of people around Hendricks were dead. And, I mean, I don't know if it's ever going to be reopened, but I've got an interesting interview with a man who says he was told how it was done, and he told me he knew the men who did it. But on tape, he says, but if I tell you, they'll be coming after me.
Yeah, I bet they would. That's hell of a motive.
And you've got the motive. You've got the story. Hendricks was so depressed. I know that Billy Cox, the bass player, I've talked to him. You know, he doesn't talk too much about this, but I know that Hendricks was very depressed. And at the Isle of Wight, I think he stops playing within 15 minutes, walks off stage and says, we just can't get it together. And then he was dead. So, I mean, what is going on? I mean, the stories, to me, I love great stories, and I love to tell great stories. And whether I was telling you something from The Rime of the Ancient Mariner or if I'm telling you The Curse of 27, what it is, it's great literature as far as the stories. And as urban legends, they should live forever.
Thank you for joining me, Gary. I look forward to having you back on to discuss your other book, The Walrus's Paul. For more information about Gary Patterson and his various projects, visit rgarypatterson.com. That's rgarypattersonsn.com. You can also like him on Facebook at r.gary.patterson.
This has been the Mason Vera Payne Show. Thanks for listening. Can't wait to hear more? Subscribe, rate, and comment at masonverapayne.com. That's masonverapayne.com. Also, follow Mason on Facebook and Twitter at Mason Vera Payne. That's all one word. And don't forget to share the show with your friends.